How far I digress from what I've prepared, I find. Before I get started, I was made aware that the exercise we did to finish yesterday on Darius and Daniel 6, there were some souls who left somewhat agitated as to whether there is a flat character in Daniel chapter 6, and that I should address this before we go any further. So when you read Daniel chapter 6, I would say, yes, indeed, there is a flat character in Daniel chapter 6. Darius is the round character. As some of my students pointed out once, the lions tend to be fairly round characters by the end of the story as well. But Darius is a round character, and the main flat character is Daniel. Because remember, when we say a character is flat, this isn't a negative judgment on them. And we're not saying they're dull, never invite them home for Sabbath lunch because they're flat. We mean, in this particular narrative, they've got one characteristic. And in Daniel 6, Daniel is consistently righteous, does the right thing, doesn't bend the knee, and remains faithful to the end. So one of the interesting things in that story is to compare how Daniel is absolutely consistent and Darius is a bit here and there. He does one thing, then he backtracks, then he's sorry he's done this and so on. So the contrast between the two makes the story interesting, I would say. More interesting than if we don't do that. Well, we had a marathon session yesterday. And so we'll try not to... Some people run a marathon every day of the week, so we're not going to do that. We're going to take a look at the book of Jonah, and we're going to look at the book of Jonah as a story. Obviously, up to now, we have looked here and we've looked there and we've looked at different places in the Bible to see how Bible stories are written and the kinds of conventions and techniques that we find there. My intention today is to take much of what we've been looking and applying all of that to one story. All right, so that we're going to work through it and see how this story can come alive if we look at this and we look at that and we look at some other aspects. Now, I'm sure the book of Jonah, only 48 verses, it's a short book and relatively short story, is familiar to us, but let's just scan the book quickly, just to refresh our memories of the flow of the story before we get into it. So we turn to the book of Jonah, which is easy to locate because it comes immediately after Obadiah. Right. So the story of Obadiah... Sorry. The story of Jonah begins. The word of the Lord comes to Jonah saying, go to Nineveh, that great city, and cry against it because their wickedness has come up before me. But in response, Jonah flees in the opposite direction. He gets on board a ship. A great storm starts. The sailors are worried as to whether they're going to survive this. Why is there a storm? They interrogate Jonah. They discover that Jonah is the cause of their problems, and he tells them, you can solve this problem by throwing me overboard, which they do. And then the Lord provides a large fish. It swallows up Jonah just as well, because without that, Jonah would be dead. And he's so pleased to be down in the innards of a fish. Yeah, because this is his salvation. And so the second chapter, Jonah prayed to the Lord his God from the belly of the fish. It's a wonderful psalm of thanksgiving. Essentially saying, I was going to die, but you saved me. It's so wonderful to be saved. And then the fish vomits him out. I could comment on that, but we'll keep going. Chapter 3. Now he's back on dry land. And the word of the Lord comes to him a second time. And so Jonah sets off for Nineveh and he delivers the message. In 40 days, Nineveh will be destroyed. In Hebrew, just five words. That's his sermon. Some congregations wish their pastors would take their cue from Jonah. Brevity, okay? Remarkably, the people of Nineveh respond to his message that in 40 days Nineveh is going to be destroyed. They repent. And God says, fair enough, I'll accept their repentance. Chapter 4, Jonah is stark, raving, bonkers mad that that's what God has done. Sits outside the city, looking at it, just wishing for the city to be destroyed. And God makes a plant to grow up over Jonah's head to give him shade. And then the next day a worm attacks the plant and the plant withers. And Jonah is mad that the plant has gone. And then God asks him the question, is it right for you to be angry about the bush? And Jonah replies, yes, angry enough to die. A suggestion this man has got a problem with a sense of proportion here. And then God asks the question at the end of the book. You are worried about the plant which came into being in a night and perished in a night. Shouldn't I have a concern for Nineveh, with all those people? And that's it. The story ends on a question. So that's the story of Jonah, all right? I mean, I know that you knew that, but just to refresh our memories. Now, let's begin with one of the major ways in which Bible stories are different from the stories which we commonly hear or read today, and that is repetition. I know when I was showing a few slides, I sort of almost heard whispers in the congregation. People say, it's repetition. Repetition. Yeah. So I'm going to start by looking at repetition and the impact that it makes on the story. So we're going to look at a comparison between God, remember God is a character in the story, and the pagan captain, the captain of the ship that Jonah is on in the first chapter. Now in verse 2, God says to Jonah, arise. Now, the Hebrew word is kum. Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and cry out, the word kara, cry out against it, for their wickedness has come up before me. So that is those are the words of God. Arise and cry out. And remember, Jonah dashes off in the opposite direction. Now, goes off to Tarshish. Not quite sure where Tarshish is. It's probably Spain, although some people suggest it might be Cornwall. Pardon?
Yeah, it is.
Because there is a possibility that it was from the lead mines in Cornwall that found their way all the way over to Phoenicia. And in other words, God says, you know, go there, and Jonah goes as far in the opposite direction as he possibly could. It's more likely Spain, I think. Sorry about that, but I think it's more likely to Spain. By the way, a return journey to Spain from Israel took 2 years. 2 year return trip. So this is not, you know, going to me coming to Crete for the weekend. You know, it's much more serious. Sorry, I shouldn't have digressed, but arise, this is the point. Arise, cry out. And Jonah ignores it, runs in the opposite direction. So he's down in the hold of the ship in the middle of a storm, and he's fast asleep. And the ship's captain comes down to him, and this is what the ship's captain bellows in his ears as he's shaking him awake. Verse 6. The tension, I can't take it. So the captain came to him and said to him, what do you mean, sleeper? Arise, call on your God. Perhaps your God will consider us so that we may not perish. The captain of the ship repeats the very words of God. Arise, call, kum kara in Hebrew. So God says, kum kara. The ship's captain says, kum kara. He must have thought it was God himself down in that ship, yelling in his ears. So the repetition here, okay, now, this is a prophetic book. And here we have a pagan repeating the very words of God. Now, in most prophetic books, who would we normally expect to be giving us the word of God? The prophet. But this prophet is asleep, and it's the pagan captain who's repeating the words of God. Now, that might seem to be an odd comparison, but as we move into the book, this becomes more obvious. Now, something else as well. At the end of chapter 1, so we're comparing the end of chapter 1 with the end of chapter 2. At the end of chapter 1, you recall that there's been the great storm and they've thrown Jonah overboard. Then the men, this is the sailors on board the ship, the men feared the Lord even more. I've given you a literal translation here. And they sacrificed a sacrifice. I mean, what else do you do with a sacrifice, right? They sacrificed a sacrifice to the Lord and they vowed vows. That's a literal translation. That's typical Hebrew way of speaking. You remember in the book of Revelation, John has a vision in which he sees harpers harping on their harps. Well, I mean, what else do you do with a harp, right? You're not going to harp on your trumpet, you know? Harpers harping on their harps. You're sacrificing sacrifices. You're vowing vows. That's a way, actually, which shows us that John, in writing Revelation, was writing Greek, but he was thinking in Hebrew or Aramaic, because that isn't a Greek way of expression. So that's what these pagan sailors do at the end of chapter 1. Sacrifice sacrifices and vow vows. At the end of chapter 2, Jonah is coming to the end of that wonderful psalm of praise in which he's thanking God for saving him. And what does he say? But with the voice of thanksgiving, but I with the voice of thanksgiving will sacrifice to you. What I have vowed, I will pay. Deliverance belongs to the Lord. So you see, at the end of chapter 1, we have pagans talking about, well, no, they don't. Pagans sacrificing and making vows. And then at the end of the next chapter, we have Jonah saying he will sacrifice and make vows. So the experience of those pagan sailors is being repeated in the experience of the prophet Jonah. And there's an obvious parallel between the experience of those sailors and Jonah. The sailors have been saved from death, and Jonah has been saved from death. So pagans and the Jewish prophet alike give thanks to God and make that commitment. However, the pagans are doing this at the end of chapter 1. We have to wait to the end of chapter 2 to hear the prophet get around to saying that. Now, of course, you could say, well, he can hardly offer a sacrifice down in the belly of the fish. He's got to wait a bit longer, doesn't he? Yeah, but the story is separating this, and those who first make this move toward God are pagans, thanking God for saving them. And then the prophet thanking God for saving him. Another aspect of repetition is, in the first chapter of Jonah, we come back to the captain of the ship again. He says, what are you doing sound asleep? Get up, call on your God. Perhaps the God will spare us a thought so that we do not perish. Let me read these passages and I'll comment on them. And then in verses 14 to 15, then they cried out to the Lord, please, O Lord, we pray, do not let us perish on account of this man's life. Do not make us guilty of innocent blood. For you, O Lord, have done as it pleased you. So they picked up Jonah and threw him into the sea, and the sea ceased from its raging. And one more passage, and then I'll comment on it. My batteries are going low here. Yes. Then Jonah prayed to the Lord his God from the belly of the fish, saying, I called to the Lord out of my distress, and he answered me. Out of the belly of Sheol, the grave, I cried, and you heard my voice. Now, let's come back over here. What we have here is the pagan captain saying, call, perhaps God will spare us so that we do not perish. So what do? The pagans cried out to the Lord, do not let us perish. And the sea ceased from its raging. So here, God answers the sincere prayer of the pagan sailors. Chapter 2, Jonah called to the Lord, just like the pagans called to the Lord over here, and you heard my voice. In other words, God answers the sincere prayer of both pagans and Jews alike. He's no respecter of persons. And that repetition underlines that. Now you can see with the repetitions that we've had so far, we're getting quite a lot of comparisons between pagans and the Jewish prophet, right? The pagans and God's own people. And that's something we've got to bear in mind as we continue. If we look at some these pagan reactions, so we're going to compare now Jonah chapter 1 with Jonah chapter 3. In Jonah 1, the captain came and said to him, what are you doing? Sound asleep. Get up, call on your God. Perhaps the God will spare us a thought so that we do not perish. Those are the words of the captain of the ship. He's not an Israelite. And in Jonah 3, we find ourselves with Jonah in the city of Nineveh. And we meet the king of Nineveh. And he says something remarkably similar. The king had a proclamation made in Nineveh. Human beings and animals shall be covered with sackcloth, and they shall cry mightily to God. Who knows? God may relent and change his mind. He may turn from his fierce anger so that we do not perish. All right? So, the captain had said, call on your God. The king says, cry mightily to God. The captain says, perhaps. The king says, who knows? So this is a possibility. Perhaps the God will spare us. God may relent and change his mind. The captain says, so that we do not perish. And the king, so that we do not perish. Well, some fairly striking similarities or repetitions here. In other words, the experience of the people of Nineveh is remarkably similar to the experience of the sailors on board that ship. Now, part of the purpose of this repetition, I think, is this. In chapter 1, we meet those sailors, and I'd suggest that we're drawn to them. They seem pretty good people. Amen. They do all they can. I mean, Jonah says, look, throw me overboard. That'll solve the problem. Throw you overboard? No. They do everything they can to get that boat to shore, but they cannot. Putting Jonah overboard is a last resort. And when they do so, they say, oh, Lord, please don't hold this against us. So those pagans, and the ship's captain, he wants to save everybody on board his ship. These are good, honest men of the sea, Doug. You know, they're salt of the earth, as we say, right? However, when we're in Jonah 3, we are in Nineveh. And Nineveh is Israel's deadliest enemy. These are the Assyrians, the people who perfected torture techniques. If you've ever been to the British Museum and you go to the Assyrian galleries, you'll see all kinds of reliefs from the palace walls of Nineveh and other Assyrian cities, which shows incredible cruelty. There's one little scene, I remember, where you've got the emperor sitting down for a feast with a beautiful princess. You know, it's kind of a palace scene. And you see the table spread with all kinds of delicacies and a bough of a tree coming over. And then your attention is drawn to something on the bough of the tree. And it is a human head. This is somebody who's been decapitated, and it is just gently blowing in the breeze, as if the emperor is saying to this beautiful princess, remember, sweetheart, who's in control around here. Terribly, probably they have the reputation of being the most cruel people in the ancient world, the deadliest enemies. Now, it's one thing to love those cuddly sailors on board the ship, but can you transfer your positive feelings from those pagans on board the ship to these dyed-in-the-wool horrors in Nineveh? Well, that's the question we've got to bear in mind. Then, another comparison between chapter 1 and chapter 3. On board the ship, the men feared the Lord. These are the pagan sailors. The men feared the Lord even more, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows. What happens in Nineveh? Maybe I should come this side. What happens in Nineveh is that the people of Nineveh believed God, proclaimed a fast, and everyone great and small put on sackcloth. So on board the ship, the men feared the Lord. In Nineveh, they believed God. Similar response. They offered a sacrifice. Here they proclaimed a fast. And you know, in the Old Testament, sacrifice and fasting go hand in hand. So the people of Nineveh give a similar response than those sailors on board the ship. So we're building up, through repetition, a series of comparisons between chapter 1 and chapter 3. Transfer those positive feelings you had about pagans in chapter 1 over to the harder nuts to crack, which are the people of Nineveh in chapter 3. Some more repetition, and that is in Jonah's prayers. In chapter 2, Jonah prayed to the Lord his God from the belly of the fish, saying, I called to the Lord out of my distress, and he answered me. Out of the belly of Sheol I cried, and you brought up my life from the pit, O Lord my God. So Jonah prays to the Lord. What does he pray to the Lord? He's praying that the Lord might save his life. And you brought up my life from the pit, O Lord my God. Jonah prays just twice in the book. This is his first prayer. His second prayer comes in chapter 4. He prayed to the Lord. The words are identical in the original language. He prayed to the Lord and said, and now, O Lord, what? Take my life from me. Prays twice. First prayer, save my life. Second prayer, take my life. He prays to the Lord to save his life because he wants to be saved. And he prays to the Lord to take his life because he is mad that other people have been saved, people of Nineveh. So he can pray giving thanks for his own salvation, but he can't pray giving thanks for other people's salvation. Just a wee bit of narrow-mindedness there, you might think. So that's repetition within the story of Jonah. We also looked at how you can have repetition between stories. Remember, we looked at the story of Moses on Mount Sinai and Elijah on the mountain. You remember? I should have been doing this long enough. I mean, teaching long enough to realize you don't ask people, do they remember? Because honest people look down at their feet, and those who want to encourage me nod their heads, but it's not necessarily an indication of where the truth lies. But I did do it, okay.
We remember.
Right. So we're going to compare now, between now, the story of Jonah and also Elijah, once again. So in Jonah chapter 1, verses 1 to 3, the word of the Lord came to Jonah, son of Amittai, saying, "Go at once to Nineveh, that great city, and cry out against it, for their wickedness has come up before me." I just want to draw attention to this phrase, "The word of the Lord came to," in this case Jonah, "saying, go." Now there are only three places in the Bible which have that phraseology. The word of the Lord came to somebody, saying, go. There are only three occurrences. This is one of them in Jonah 1. The other two are in 1 Kings chapter 17. The word of the Lord came to him, that is Elijah, saying, go from here and turn eastward and hide yourself by the Wadi Cherith, which is east of the Jordan. And the second in verses 8 and 9, "Then the word of the Lord came to him, saying, go now to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and live there, for I have commanded a widow there to feed you." So the way in which the word of the Lord comes to Jonah, saying, go, recalls the word of the Lord coming to Elijah, saying, go, and the word of the Lord coming to Elijah again, saying, go. Why does it remind us? Because those are the only three places in the Bible which use that phraseology. Now, that might, you might say that's somewhat accidental, perhaps. But let's look at the other detail. Over here, where does God tell Jonah to go? I'm indicating it in case you're guessing. Right? He tells him to go where? Right. And over here, he tells him to go to the Wadi Cherith, and where is that?
East of the Jordan.
And here, he tells him to go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon. What do Nineveh, the Wadi Cherith, east of the Jordan, and Zarephath, what do they have in common? They're all outside Israel. All of them are outside Israel. And it's only Jonah and Elijah. Sorry, I'm just flicking through my file in my mind to make sure that, yeah. It is only Jonah and Elijah who are told to go outside of Israel as prophets. So the phraseology brings together Jonah and Elijah as far as the word of the Lord coming to them, but also, like Elijah on those two occasions, Jonah also has to go beyond Israel, go beyond his comfort zone, if you like. So this is at the beginning of the book, right? This is at the beginning of the book. If we are biblically literate, which we are, we will notice this similarity. Okay, I'm sure you noticed that even before I told you, right? But let's go to the end of the book of Jonah, and again we see parallels between Jonah and Elijah. So we start with Elijah this time, okay? In 1 Kings 19, verse 4, "He himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a solitary broom tree, and he asked that he might die. It is enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I'm no better than my ancestors." That's Elijah. So what's Elijah doing? Well, he's sitting down under a solitary broom tree, and he says, "Lord, take away my life." With Jonah, "And now, O Lord, please take my life from me, for it's better for me to die than to live." And the Lord God appointed a bush and made it come up over Jonah to give shade over his head. So with Elijah, he's sitting under a tree saying, "Take my life from me." And Jonah is saying, "Take my life from me," sitting under this plant. which is probably a tropical cucumber gourd, for those of you interested in that sort of thing. So they're in the same situation, and they offer the same prayer. The Hebrew, "take away my life," it's identical for both of them. It's as if Jonah is quoting Elijah. But why does Elijah want to die? Well, Elijah wants to die because of opposition. Why does Jonah want to die? Because, well, he's mad, and he's mad, or put it this way, he wants to die because he's been successful. You know, Lord, I had my evangelistic campaign in Crieff, and we baptized 693 people. Take my life from me, I just want to die. It would seem a bit odd, wouldn't it? You see, the kind of character that Jonah is appearing to be through these repetitions and comparisons, he comes across very negatively in comparison with Elijah. One other aspect of repetitions between stories, well, it's a repetition between Jonah and another biblical book, although not explicitly another Bible story, and that is the repetition between Jonah and Nahum, the book of Nahum. Now, the book of Nahum is not on everybody's frequent, you know, reading list. It's one of those minor prophets which we don't refer to very often. But let's remind ourselves of the way in which Jonah finishes. Jonah finishes with this: "Should I not be concerned about Nineveh, that great city in which there are more than 120,000 persons who do not know their right hand from their left, and also many animals?" The book of Jonah ends on a question. Nahum chapter 3. "All who hear news about you." Well, who is the "you" in the book of Nahum? It is Nineveh. There are only two books in the Bible directed explicitly at Nineveh. One of them is Jonah, the other one is Nahum, or Nahum, if you want to be more precise. "All who hear the news about you clap their hands over you, for who has ever escaped your endless cruelty?" You notice that Jonah and Nahum end with a question. These are the only two biblical books to end on a question. The only two biblical books that are concerned entirely with Nineveh. But in Jonah, the question is pointing in the direction of salvation, whereas in Nahum, the question is pointing in the direction of judgment on the same city of Nineveh. So that repetition between the two books, the similarity of the way in which these two books end, only books dealing with Nineveh, the only books to end on a question, suggests that we need to read these two books together. The salvation perspective of Jonah, but the judgment perspective of Nahum. Let's have a look now at the question of structure. You know, we looked at the way in which biblical stories are put together. We'll take a look at the first chapter of Jonah. I'm going to have to go through this in summary form. I think it might take too long to look at each detail, but we did consider chiasms, you remember, one of the ways in which biblical stories are arranged, where the second half of the story is the mirror image of the first half. And it would seem to me that in the first chapter of Jonah, we have a chiasm. So let me take you through it, and then I'll comment on the significance that I see. So I have to come here to make sure this thing will advance. So the first three verses are general introduction. You know, the word of the Lord came to Jonah, saying, "Go," and he went in the opposite direction. So The storm begins with pagans worshipping their gods. And then, because they are in the middle of a storm, they throw goods into the sea in order to lighten the ship. And then the captain expresses hope for deliverance from the storm. Remember, this is where the captain comes to Jonah and says, "Arise, call upon your God, you know, so that we do not perish." And then the sailors discuss the culprit. I mean, why is this happening? Who's to blame? And then they discover that Jonah is the cause of the problems, because he's told them that. So the sailors interrogate Jonah. "Tell us, who are you? Where do you come from? What do you do?" And then Jonah, standing on board ship, bears marvelous testimony to his deep faith in God. He says, "I am a Hebrew, and I worship the Lord who made heaven and earth." Sort of gets you here, doesn't it? You know? What a great fellow. That's the turning point in this chiasm. The rest of the story then is in reverse order. So the sailors continue to interrogate Jonah. "What shall we do? What do you think?" They again repeat that Jonah is the cause of the problems. And then the sailors discuss the punishment. What are we going to do with the fellow? And Jonah states the means of deliverance from the storm: "Throw me overboard." And the sailors throw Jonah into the sea. And the storm ends with the pagans worshipping the Lord. So can you see the comparison? We begin with the pagans worshipping their gods, and the storm ends with pagans worshipping the Lord. They've moved from worshipping their gods to worshipping the Lord. The sailors throw goods into the sea. Here, the sailors throw Jonah into the sea. The captain expresses hope of deliverance, and Jonah states the means of deliverance from the storm, and so on. You see, so there's this balance in the two halves of the chiasm. Now, verse 9 of Jonah, which is the central point in this chiasm, he says — I want to get the words right here — he says, "I am a Hebrew. I worship the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land." It's a wonderful testimony. Until we ask, why is Jonah on board this ship? Jonah is on board this ship, we're told, because he wanted to get away from the presence of the Lord. Now you see, Jonah is a classic example of somebody who knows the fundamental beliefs, but has never thought, or never asked the "so what" question. "I am a Hebrew, and I worship the Lord who made heaven and earth." Sorry, I get the exact words — "who made the sea and the dry land." And yet he's on board this ship because he's running away. Now, the significance of it then, on the one hand, is to tell us something about Jonah. How can you believe this and yet be doing what you're doing? If you believe that, if God is the creator of all the sea and the dry land, how does going on a Mediterranean cruise get you away from God? But the other thing is this: that God is the creator of all things. God is the creator of all things in the world. And the rest of the book of Jonah is really a commentary on that. If you believe that God is the creator of the whole world, the creator of all things, well, so what? And the rest of the book explores the limits of that belief. How far are you willing to push that belief? Does it include Ninevites or not? So this structure, centering on this statement of faith, all right? Jonah's theology is straight. but his soul is bent. Because as we can see in the story, he cannot love pagans. Anyway, that's one aspect of the structure of the book. The other aspect of the structure of the book of the book of Jonah is we have four chapters, and the book is set up as two sets of parallel chapters. Jonah chapter 1 and Jonah chapter 3. Those two belong together. And then Jonah chapter 2 and Jonah chapter 4. Those two belong together. So let me illustrate how that works. Briefly, in chapter 1, God calls Jonah to go to Nineveh. The word, we're told, comes to Jonah, and he disobeys, runs off in the opposite direction. And the captain tells Jonah to cry to God. I mean, lots of other things happen, but those are some of the major things that happen in chapter 1. In chapter 3, what happens? I'm trying to give you a balanced picture, you know, left wing, right wing. And God calls Jonah to go to Nineveh, you know, for the second time. And the word, we're told, comes to the king of Nineveh, and he obeys. Jonah disobeyed, but the king obeys. And the king tells Nineveh to cry to God. So you see, these two chapters are crying out for comparison. Very similar things happen in chapter 1 and in chapter 3. If we look at the other pair of chapters, chapters 2 and 4. In chapter 2, Jonah is very happy when he is saved. I mean, he can hardly contain himself. I mean, I would have difficulty composing a poem of this quality if I had spent several days in my study working hard at it. But he does it in the intestines of a fish. I mean, what a fella. Chapter 2, Jonah asks God to save his life. And in chapter 4, Jonah is very angry when Nineveh is saved. And Jonah asks God to take his life. See, chapter 2, chapter 4. Very happy in chapter 2, very angry in chapter 4. Save my life in chapter 2, take my life in chapter 4. By the way, in chapter 4 also, if you translate the literally, you know, the when he sees that Nineveh has been saved, literally the Hebrew says he was mad with great madness. He was mad with great madness, which is a Hebrew way of saying you can't get any more distraught than that. But you remember the plant that comes up over his head? That cucumber plant? It says literally, with the plant, Jonah was glad, with great gladness. So you're glad with great gladness for a cucumber plant, but you're mad with great madness that Nineveh's been saved. Just as well we don't have Jonahs in our churches these days. Now, another aspect of Bible stories, multiple meanings. This is one of my favorite aspects of the book of Jonah. Remember multiple meanings. Remember we looked at, I shouldn't say you remember, but we did look at how David, in the story about David wanting to build a house for the Lord, and why do you want to build a house for me, and I will build a house for you. Remember how the word house had three different meanings? Well, we've got a real I'd say, a real cracker example of how Bible story uses a word with multiple meanings here. And the word, the word is hafak. Now, the word hafak can mean to overturn. And this is part of the single narrow dominant thought of Jonah's sermon to Nineveh. He cried out, 40 days more and Nineveh shall be overthrown. Hafak. I mean, it's got that sort of sound to it, doesn't it? You know, hafak doesn't mean I love you. Right? It's the same word that is used in Genesis to describe the overturn of the cities of the plain, Sodom and Gomorrah. God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew hafak, the cities, Sodom and Gomorrah, in which Lot had settled. So, his message seems quite straightforward, except that the verb hafak has got two distinct meanings. It can mean to overturn, or it can mean to turn around in the sense of converting something from one thing to another. For example, from Jeremiah, there are several examples of it, this is just one. Then shall the young women rejoice in the dance, and the young men and the old shall be merry. I will turn, I will hafak, I will convert their mourning, their weeping, into joy. I will comfort them and give them gladness for sorrow. So, my dear brothers and sisters, in 40 days, Nineveh will be hafak. In 40 days, Nineveh will be overturned. Or in 40 days, Nineveh will be turned around. In 40 days, Nineveh will be converted. How did Jonah understand hafak? Oh, he was clear. It's the first meaning, quite clearly. But of course, that raises the interesting question, which I've heard asked a number of times in Sabbath school classes. Jonah prophesies something about Nineveh and it doesn't happen. But I think it's more subtle than that. In 40 days, well, let me ask you, is Jonah's prophecy fulfilled or is it not fulfilled? Well, it's fulfilled, but not in the way that Jonah thought it would be fulfilled. He was hoping it would be hafak, overturn, but it turns out to be hafak in turn around, convert. So you can understand that native speakers of Hebrew, when they see that multiple meaning, that sort of play on words, they're listening to the story, and they say, that was clever, I see that. But it underlines something about Jonah. He can rejoice in the possibility of one kind of hafak, but he's mad with great madness when it turns out to be another form of hafak. Right, and then another aspect. Yeah, another aspect. We looked at plot in Bible stories. And the book of Jonah, four chapters, and three of those chapters are stories with plots. Chapter two is a poem, it's a psalm, so it doesn't have a plot, but the other three chapters do. Let me illustrate from chapter three. You have an initial situation. I've just put the definition there just to jog your memories. The initial situation in chapter three. Is The word of the Lord came to Jonah a second time, saying, get up, go to Nineveh, that great city, and proclaim to it the message that I tell you. So Jonah set out and went to Nineveh according to the word of the Lord. Now Nineveh was an exceedingly large city, a 3 days' walk across. Jonah began to go into the city, going a day's walk, and he cried out, 40 days more, and Nineveh shall be overthrown. Okay, there's the initial situation. He's now preaching. Complication. The people of Nineveh believed God. Well, that's a complication, isn't it? You're going to be destroyed, according to Jonah's thinking. But they believe. They proclaimed a fast. Everyone, great and small, put on sackcloth. So the transforming action has the king here saying, by the decree of the king and his nobles, no human being or animal, no herd or flock shall taste anything. They shall not feed, nor shall they drink water. Human beings and animals shall be covered with sackcloth, and they shall cry mightily to God. All shall turn from their evil ways and from the violence that is in their hands. Who knows? Okay, who knows? So this is the response to that complication. Perhaps, who knows, God may relent and change his mind. He may turn from his fierce anger so that we do not perish. Resolution. When God saw what they did, how they turned from their evil ways, God changed his mind about the calamity that he'd said he would bring upon them. And he did not do it. And this resolution, by the way, it does double duty as the final situation. There isn't a final situation in chapter 3. But just to show you how plot works in Jonah. But in addition to that, we need to consider this point that we looked at earlier about Jonah ending on a question. Verse 11. And should I not be concerned about Nineveh? This is God speaking to Jonah, remember. Should I not be concerned about Nineveh, that great city in which there are more than 120,000 persons who do not know their right hand from their left, and also many animals? So that's God's question, right? What is Jonah's response to the question? Well, we think that's going through his mind. But explicitly, I should have made that clear, explicitly in the story, how does Jonah respond to that final question? It stops. It doesn't. Because what we have is an interrupted story. So here's an example of a plot which deliberately is left open-ended. Because I think this is directed to Jonah, but it's directed to those of us who hear this story. What is your answer to that question? You know, when Jesus taught, he would occasionally end with a question, or he would ask questions to get a response. Well, this is similar here. And it's an example, I would suggest, of words of advice to people preaching on Jonah. Because the book ends on an open question, the preacher's temptation is to provide the answer. But the book has no interest in providing the answer. It's interested in us answering it for ourselves. When God says, shouldn't I show pity for Nineveh? I don't know. What do you think? Should God or shouldn't he? Well, I'm not looking for answers now. I'm just talking about the dynamics of the story. So that's a way in which this is called an interrupted story. And another example, which we don't have time to look at, but the parable that Jesus tells, you know, of the workmen coming at various times of the day, and those at the end who turn up just as the klaxon in the factory is about to blow get paid the same as everybody's been working right at the beginning. Sorry about that. yeah, it's one of those things. Now that happens, and I got to the age where I can't get back to where I was. Yeah, in that parable, if you look at the parable, you'll see that also ends on an open. It doesn't finish it off, because it's up to us to answer that question. I'm wondering whether I've got a little bit more to say, and then we would have some questions. We're planning on having a break, is that right? So why don't we take a break now? I've just got something very short to finish off, and then we'll have time for questions and answers on everything we've done over the last few days. Okay, and Mike is now opening the back door to accommodate the stampede to the room at the back. Okay.